supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Today, a judge signed off on a deal requiring Sunoco Pipeline to step up its protection of water sources during construction of the Mariner East 2 pipeline. This comes after dozens of spills of drilling fluid contaminated some homeowners' private wells and at least one wetland. Joining me now to discuss the latest is State Impact Pennsylvania's John Hurdle. John, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Review how we got to this point.
Well, last month, the judge ordered Sunoco to temporarily stop drilling after a chorus of complaints from environmental groups and residents whose water was affected by the spills. Since April, there have been dozens of spills from drilling fluid during construction of the pipeline, which will carry natural gas liquids from southwest Pennsylvania all the way across the state to an export terminal at Marcus Hook near Philadelphia. The spills resulted in many homeowners having cloudy water, prompting Sunoco to hand out bottled water to some communities. The environmental groups asked the judge to extend the drilling ban and were set to argue their case before the state's Environmental Hearing Board this week. Then, last night, we got word that the groups and Sunoco had reached a settlement agreement. Now the judge has signed off on that agreement and made it official.
John, can you be more specific by what is meant by the term cloudy water?
Various residents that I've spoken to have described it as like soup, and they've said that it was just undrinkable.
Was any of that water subjected to testing to more definitively determine what was causing that opaqueness?
It has been tested, but the results have not been published.
So what has Sunoco committed to doing?
Well, essentially, the company's agreed to do more to protect private water supplies. It will give landowners 10 days' notice of its plans to drill, and it'll take a fresh look at the geology of the sites where it conducts horizontal directional drilling. It's also going to test homeowners' water before, during, and after drilling. Now, in return, the environmental groups withdrew their court challenge. Now, I should add that the groups are still challenging the permits issued to Sunoco by the state's Department of Environmental Protection in a separate court challenge that's expected to be heard in coming months.
Now, John, as far as Sunoco's business plans with the pipeline, do these extra protections translate into a delay for the project's implementation?
Well, it could. The project has already experienced considerable delays, partly because of repeated requests by the state for more information for the Sunoco permits. And today, the company actually had an earnings call in which it said that it now expects to complete the project in the fourth quarter of this year, and that would be back from its previous target of the third quarter.
Now, back to those homeowners whose water was contaminated. What's their status at this point?
Well, Sunoco agreed to provide at least one community with hook it up to the public water mains, and that's in West Whiteland in Chester County. Other people have been receiving bottled water, and the company initially agreed to pay for affected homeowners to either shower in hotels or stay in hotels while their water was affected.
Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
State Impact Pennsylvania's John Hurdle on NewsWorks Tonight. Three years ago, Delaware's governor put six low-performing Wilmington schools in high-poverty areas on notice. Improve, or we might shut your doors. Today, they remain open, but they're still struggling, as WHYY's Chris Barish reports.
To reach their bus stop at 3rd and Franklin Streets, Warner Elementary School students travel a treacherous stretch. They walk lots where armed drug dealers do a brisk business, and several people have been shot in recent months. Boarded or run-down brick homes line the streets. Empty plastic bags for heroin and cocaine dot pitted sidewalks. Carmen Monzon bemoans the environment her grandkids endure on the way to school.
This is like drug central, you know. Most of these people, that's what they do. It's not the school, and it's not the teachers. It's, you know, the upbringing and the mentality of where we live.
83% of Warner's 428 students come from poor households. Virtually all are black or Latino. Some of the third, fourth, and fifth graders board the bus with empty bellies and shabby clothes. only a scant few live with both parents. Many of those dads or moms are in prison, others killed or wounded by Wilmington's gun violence.
You will put the four down, then you put the Winsmans
down. Tarian Taylor teaches fifth grade at Warner.
I would say majority of the students are most likely being raised by a single mother. Even in the situations where there are both parents in a home, there is some kind of dysfunction with some of those families.
So is it any wonder that Warner's performance is worse than almost every other Delaware elementary school? Just one in five students are proficient in English and social studies, far below the state average. Barely one in five is up to speed in math and science. Nearly one-third of students were suspended last year.
All right, two-letter word. That's going to transition from your restate to your answer.
Fourth-grade teacher Andrew Corrigan says too many students arrive at Warner ill-prepared.
They may not have gone to preschool. In kindergarten these days, I mean, you're expected to write sentences by the time you leave. But it'd be hard to do that if you go in not even knowing your ABCs or how to spell your name.
In 2014, Delaware dedicated about $1 million over 4 years to help Warner and five other so-called priority schools. But Principal Krishan Fitzgerald wants to dispel the notion that hers is a bad school of unruly students and burned out teachers.
Our teachers work hard every day. Our students come in, they're respectful, responsible, prepared, and safe, and academically focused, and the work is happening.
Warner teachers meet twice a week about boosting test scores. The school added a social and emotional learning program and a behavioral interventionist who works with kids with disciplinary issues.
So if you are doing the exact same thing all the time and you know that it's wrong and you continue doing it, it's going to become your what?
Habit.
Your habit.
Parental involvement, while still lagging, has improved. There are dozens of partnerships with groups that donate items such as coats, book bags, or weekend food packages. Warner set goals that are more wish list than realistic, including having 40% of students up to speed in math in 2 years. But Corrigan says there are more meaningful ways to measure students.
If you're judging off a statewide test, yeah, we're a low-performing school. But if you're judging off growth and what these kids did when they came in to what they're doing when they're leaving, I mean, they make tremendous growth.
Watch your thoughts, for they become your words.
Beyond academics, Harold Pritchett teaches kids social and emotional skills. He helps them develop empathy in relationships as well as improve their decision-making. All children attend his class weekly, not just those flagged for bad behavior. The class covers a lot of territory.
So when we meditate, we look at ourselves when?
When
we first wake up. And then we see ourselves coming to school. And then we see ourselves come into class, so then we can look back on our day and we can see when we were doing what? The right thing and the bad thing. And who can correct us? We correct ourselves.
The bottom line is that Warner will almost certainly always trail more affluent schools. But that doesn't deter Taylor and other educators who wear several hats in hopes of providing students with stability and perhaps that spark of inspiration.
We're pretty much here to be everything that they need, the psychologist, the dad, the uncle, the preacher, teacher, whatever we need to be. Our job here is to kind of just be everything that they don't have and hopefully, you know, help mold them into productive citizens.
There's unanimous agreement in Delaware that schools like Warner need to perform better. While it's still under state scrutiny, students have made enough progress that right now no one is talking about closing the school. Chris Barish, WHYY News.
1 week may seem like a moment when compared to a lifetime, though for medical student Max Ellithorpe, 1 week can be life-changing. He shares lessons learned from his time in a psychiatric hospital.
After noticing the warning signs of severe depression, I became a part of Pennsylvania's mental health system on July 18, 2017. I signed what is affectionately referred to by patients as a 201 form, surrendering myself voluntarily to be cared for by mental health professionals in an inpatient setting. I was referred by my psychiatrist to a crisis response center, a triage and intake facility for individuals suffering from acute mental health issues. After spending hours in an uncomfortable waiting room, I was transferred by ambulance in a heavily medicated and confused state to a sprawling psychiatric hospital far from where I lived. Upon arriving, I was held in yet another CRC, evaluated by a triage team, and assigned to a ward. I was thoroughly searched and surrendered my belt, my shoes, my phone, and my freedom. A friendly but cautious mental health technician escorted me up to my new home. It took me a few hours after I was admitted to truly understand where I was, and then the tears arrived. I struggled with competing thoughts. Being a pre-med student, I immediately framed this as an opportunity to learn, focusing on evaluating the facility and its many problems instead of my own. But I also had feelings of desperation. I pleaded with my parents on the phone, with the psychiatrist in charge of my treatment team, and with anyone who would listen to let me out. I didn't think I belonged in such a restrictive environment and figured it was a waste of time to be in such a dull setting. But since I had used suicide buzzwords in the CRC, I was stuck for at least a week. Over the course of that week, I got to know my fellow patients. I was introduced to some who had been in and out of the facility before, someone who hoarded food in her room to share with other patients, a person diagnosed with schizophrenia who had worked for the United Nations and claimed to hold multiple PhDs. There was an ex-con with a hardened exterior and a warm heart, a heavily tattooed patient who was always there for me, and a quiet homeless man with an incredibly poetic voice. We all came from different worlds, but had one thing in common. We were all in pain. I also got to know the hospital's staff. Dr. S., the head of my treatment team, frequently told me that I should consider a career other than medicine. The patients were introduced to a variety of therapists, social workers, activity coordinators, phlebotomists, finance professionals, and nurses. Some were kinder than others. Some spoke to us in that sing-song preschool teacher's voice. Others addressed us as adults. Reflecting on this recent experience these past few days, I started to see the value of it. I was desperately seeking a reset button, a safe environment, and recovery. And despite the many grievances I had with the facility and its policies, I learned a tremendous amount about myself and others. We all had something in common, despite a wide socioeconomic spectrum separating us. Although I hated the hospital's overemphasis on risk management and its correspondingly restrictive policies, I learned to unplug, to look within, and to be present. I left the hospital in a manner similar to how I arrived. Early in the morning, somewhat confused about where to go next, with two bus tokens and a paper bag full of my belongings in my hands. But I also left with a new lease on life and gratitude towards those who had helped me along the way. I would not have been able to survive this experience without the support of my parents and dear friends who called and came to visit me. I treasured those 60 minutes granted to us every other day for in-person visits and gained a new appreciation for how lucky I was to have such a strong support system. While much of the work in my recovery remains to be accomplished, I gained some valuable tools from my experience. I now recognize the importance of unplugging, the joy that can come from being outside, and the importance of smiling. I will be forever grateful for this life-changing but difficult experience.
Max Ellithorp is a post-baccalaureate pre-med student at Temple University's Lewis Katz School of Medicine. You can read his and other stories from the region at newsworks.org/speakeasy. Drexel University is displaying a photography exhibit of America's most hazardous jobs. For nearly 50 years, photojournalist Earl Dotter has been documenting workers who put themselves in harm's way 9 to 5. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports.
Fresh out of college, Earl Dotter started photographing the most hazardous job in America, coal mining in Appalachia. That was 1969, when an explosion in Farmington, West Virginia, killed 78 miners. And then in 1972, at Buffalo Creek, West Virginia, a dam holding back 132 million gallons of coal mining wastewater burst. It wiped out thousands of workers' homes below it, killing 125 people. One of the survivors of that Buffalo Creek disaster was Paul Rhodes. He went back to work in the coal mines a year later, and Dotter took a picture of him in a shack waiting to go underground. He said it was his first portrait that was any good.
Miners' clothes had darkened the plywood walls, just rubbing against and made it kind of almost a black cavern with window light. kind of Rembrandt window light illuminating Paul's face.
At the time, a coal miner perished every other day in America. Since then, safety regulations have improved. But what interested Dodder more were the thousands of miners killed quietly over a long period of time by black lung. He went on to photograph workers in cotton mills, many of whom were sickened and died from bisonosis, also called brown lung, from breathing cotton dust. Dodder would also photograph hospital workers, commercial fishermen, people who had worked with asbestos. Sometimes the workers he photographed decades ago are only now succumbing to occupational illnesses.
Often it takes a long time to manifest itself in one's body, such as asbestos workers. They may be exposed to asbestos washing out their dad's clothing in the garage after he comes home from work, and 20 years later, they might have the disease.
The exhibition is up in Drexel University's main building until November. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
While renovations continue at the White House, President Donald Trump continues what he calls a working vacation at his golf course in northern New Jersey. Much to the chagrin of those who contend he should instead be gracing the likes of Martha's Vineyard or perhaps Kennebunkport. Joining me in defense of the Garden State is Brian Murphy, director of the Honors College at Rutgers University and associate professor in the History Department. Brian, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me on.
And truth be told, your article in Politico is a defense of a previous article that appeared in the Boston Globe. Explain.
The Boston Globe ran a piece on last Thursday saying that, you know, it was the tone of it was, look, Trump is going on vacation in New Jersey, the land of spray tans. And I've been going, you know, I'm a Jersey guy. I'm from here and I work in New Jersey now and I like living here and I go to the Jersey Shore a lot. And the article kind of laid out this case that there's something inherently déclassé.
Well, they expanded. It's not just spray tans. They also invoked snooki and muscle shirts.
Right. The Sopranos, snooki, all these cultural signals for the state being kind of a low-class place. And the counterpoint being that, you know, there was a time in America when presidents went to places like Kennebunkport and Martha's Vineyard and these respectable locations, and now Donald Trump, this kind of vulgar president, is taking a vacation in the land of vulgarity, New Jersey.
Well, Professor Murphy, put on your History Department hat. There is ample precedent for presidents pre-air conditioning spending summers in New Jersey.
Yes, there is. For as long as presidents have kind of been taking vacations, right? And the vacation is a, I think the concept of the vacation is a relatively, it's a mid-19th century, mid-1800s idea, right? That someone who worked would go somewhere, and that middle-class people, right, and sort of upper-middle-class people would kind of decamp to a different place to take a period of rest from whatever work they were doing.
Vacate, as it were.
Exactly. Presidents have been coming to New Jersey since at least the 1850s to do this. They went to Long Branch, a place on the Jersey Shore that had a train line going to it. People also, and this is where I end up going, and a lot of people from Philadelphia seem to come down there, is to Cape May County, right? The city of Cape May had a train line going there, too, before Atlantic City did. Presidents Pierce, Buchanan, Abe Lincoln went to Cape May in 1859 before he was president. And then after that, you know, we have Grant and Rutherford Hayes and Garfield and Chester Arthur and Benjamin Harrison and Woodrow Wilson, right? There's this, all the bearded guys from the latter part of the 19th century, all those guys spent a lot of time at the Jersey Shore.
Although, truth be told, one of those bearded guys, Grover Cleveland, the only New Jersey native to have been president, chose instead to go to Massachusetts Buzzards Bay.
That's right. Well, nobody's perfect, right?
Let's also note that Bedminster, New Jersey, nothing to sneeze at, where the president is now.
The article in the Globe made this point that, you know, Donald Trump's going to be putting within earshot of Interstate 78. Well, I mean, that may be true, but the membership fee at Bedminster is something in the neighborhood of $300,000. You know, regardless of whatever you think of the president, you know, the idea that there's something to apologize for by taking a vacation in this particular spot just doesn't hold water. I think, look, Martha's Vineyard is on an island, and it's, you know, part of, I think, what the Globe was calling presidential was really, they're talking about exclusivity and a particular exclusivity that comes with having a lot of money. And certainly, you know, Martha's Vineyard is not a, there's nothing egalitarian about Martha's Vineyard in the way that I think there is about the New Jersey Shore, where there are a lot of big beaches that have good public access and that don't require a fee, and you can get there by train or by bus or by car for the day.
Perhaps the Globe reporters deserve a pass to the extent that people's most recent images of the Jersey Shore perhaps were of those of Governor Chris Christie lounging while the public was kicked off.
Hey, it's such a nice place. I don't know why you wouldn't want it to yourself.
Thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Brian Murphy, director of the Honors College at Rutgers University, an associate professor in the history department. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.